Hey, y'all. Pretend we're football for the next hour. I'm your host, Will Baser, and I'm joined alongside by Johnny Brashear and Tim Preston, as always. You guys listen to the Hornscast channel, which you can find on any podcasting platform out there. Today, we're going to be going over the 3-0 stretch that has happened since Johnny wrote the article, It Is Time. Talk about what is behind that stretch.
Son of a bitch.
Where we are... Where we are now in terms of Shaka Smart and his job, what are the realities? How far away can we get with dreaming about the possibilities of what Texas could do? Because, hey, look, there's a little sliver of hope out there. Let's see how realistic holding on to that sliver of hope is. Y'all, so are we happy with Johnny Brashear's article at this point, or...
I'm always, I'm never happy with anything I write. So no, we're not.
Yeah, his writing's bad. It's just all there is to it.
That's why I keep Tim around. I appreciate his honesty.
In the moment, what he wrote was totally relevant and realistic. And I think the smart money is still on it being accurate. Right, so I don't think
there you go, Tim.
I don't think a lot of people really saw this coming after the Iowa State loss, and certainly there's reason to believe that the next three games are gonna put the dagger in our heart in the same way TCU did last year. So if I was betting my house, I would bet on Johnny's writing being still true to what real life will bring, but. Good on Texas for at least making us question things.
I'm glad you're betting your house, because I'm not even betting my own house on my writing. So thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah. Yet again, that's why I keep Tim around. He puts an undue amount of pressure and presence on me. So thank you.
And love. It's weird. The love is the pressure.
I'm not betting my house on his syntax. I'll say that much. Jesus Christ.
That's fair. There's a lot of commas in my writing.
And in your talking. So,
what?
Tim had to take his headphones off because he's laughing so hard.
The man's a savage. I love it. Oh, boy. Two people I love so much. It's incredible. All right.
Okay. So, Texas, since we last talked, and we're really, really down and pretty depressed about Texas, they're 3-0. Will Baker and Courtney Ramey have awoken. What is behind that? Is it Will Baker finally getting a chance and not having to look over his shoulders? Is that what has really woken him up? What part of his game has finally, I mean, besides putting it in the basket, has really improved the most in this past three-game stretch?
Well, I think...
It's not the length, it's the multitude.
It's the frequency. It's the frequency.
You're right. Good point. So... Will Baker, yes, he's been a one game renaissance. it helps when you guard a 7-footer with 6'5" guys. That always helps. I appreciate that. It's nice to see him hit any shots at all. Frankly, it was nice to see him take out about a season's worth of frustration in a single half. There, I don't know if he celebrated more, or the bench celebrated more, or the coaches quietly celebrated more that he was hitting those shots. It was nice to see, even if it was against TCU, who decided that, you know, Kevin Samuel could guard somebody else. As far as whether or not it's repeatable, it was nice to see in the West Virginia game, Will Baker was showing aggressiveness, and he got a lot of fouls, which is unfortunate. But if I'm trying to coach Will Baker at this point, my my coaching to him is, I would rather you foul out of aggression than out of omission. I want you to take the ball to the rack or shoot the shot you want to shoot. I want you to go for the rebound you want to go for. I would rather you do that than be timid and in your head. Like, I want you to just play to the best of your ability.
It was West Virginia, by the way.
Yeah.
Where he had four fouls. And they are very, very, what's the word, trigger happy with their whistles?
Yes.
Yeah, that was a weird game.
Yeah.
Officiated-wise, yeah.
Yeah, it was like they brought the officials from Morgantown, except they realized they weren't in Morgantown. They said, you know what, we're just going to call everybody on everything. We'll just do that.
But even then, Will Baker was pretty effective with the limited time. You know, he was in there for 20 minutes, but for those 20 minutes, he was pretty effective in what he did.
I mean, if relative to the earlier part of the season, yes. He's effective in a relative scale, yes. He got caught on a couple things, and it's a hard guard for him. The Shibue and Culver, those guys are very strong. They're very athletic. It's a difficult guard for Baker. So he put up a gamely effort. He tried. He did what he could, but he's a freshman who is not as, you know, Shibue is a whole different animal than Baker, and Baker's going to have to learn how to win those battles in the coming years. As far as Ramey, it's been nice to see this from him.
Stealing my thunder.
Yeah.
I have to say, one of the real reasons Texas turned around is because of Courtney Ramey. We talked about him in the last episode being one of the reasons that Texas hasn't done well this year. And then all of a sudden, he hits 15 points against TCU, 26 against Kansas State, and then 21 against West Virginia.
Yeah, and there is a small caveat there that some of that is due to Coleman being out or being limited, and so he got more run than he might. He was more of a primary option than a secondary option. So there's some of that, but he absolutely did perform really well in the games when Texas really needed him to, when they're sort of up against it. So it was good to see him play as well as he did. He was almost as exciting as Brock Cunningham was. So there's that.
Your love child?
It's more of a consensual relationship at this point. He's an adult, so.
From my viewpoint on both Baker and Ramey, certainly Will had the very, very good game against TCU. That was awesome.
Thank you. I thought my game against TCU was pretty good, too.
To see him kind of play with that freedom and to feel as confident as he obviously was, just to see the monkey kind of just like obviously float away from his back was a cool thing. I'm sure that obviously everyone wants him to play well, and to say he has not played well or had not played well up until that point is maybe putting it somewhat mildly. So happy for him. I think that a lot of his strengths right now have come with the fact that as Kai has gotten better as a help defender and as someone that can recover as well as Kai can around the rim, as well as the fact that Kai has done a pretty good job as a defensive rebounder over the last few games, that's helped Will. Kai makes sense because Kai can do some of the things that Jericho can because of his length and his explosiveness. But you probably can't really have Will and Jericho on the floor at the same time because it's tougher to take Jericho away from the basket. Because of his, we need his rebounding on defense, and you can't really have Will guard a four man in the league because so many four mans are like 6'5" guys who can shoot. So it's been good for Will that we've been able to kind of pair him with Kai, and Kai is getting more and more comfortable defensively. And I like a lot of things I like about Kamaka. I also like about Will. He's a good ball mover. He makes good decisions, although he has some turnover issues, and that's just sort of one of his crosses to carry or whatever, I guess, with that. But I think that Will is obviously someone that has a high basketball IQ, understands spacing, can shoot the ball. You have to respect him. He's done a good job the last few games. I want to say, I think all of the last three games, at some point, he's had a, off of a ball screen, or maybe off of a fake handoff, he's turned the corner and gotten a dunk. So maybe he didn't have one of those against West Virginia, but he surely had one against K-State and TCU. So those are both cool. So to see him add some of those wrinkles to his game where it's not just, oh, I only shoot from out here, but also kind of like finding driving lanes and stuff like that has been good. When you think about Ramey, I guess, you know, he seems like a guy who, for some players, that emotional or psychological part of the game just kind of makes a bigger difference. And so when Johnny said, well, I think that there's at least part of this where he, because of Matt not being around, he's been highlighted. And I guess I sort of just kind of wonder if that really is it. Like if he knows I'm the guy, this is my team, I'm going to be in charge of scoring, I'm going to be in charge of playmaking, this is all me, and Matt's hobbled and on one leg, and so it comes down to me, and that big moment has like brought out the best in him. I don't know why in some games he looks so lackluster, and in the last three he's been not just good but like efficiently good. So it seems like there's got to be some kind of like emotional mental part for him, because certainly he's got the skills. He showed last year that he can score in big, you know, in big moments and in, you know, big amounts. But for whatever reason, like having Matt not at 100% seems to have unlocked his mental block of, okay, this is me, I know it's me, this team is mine, now I can just sort of like allow myself to take over that those reins and be doing the things I know I can do.
I think there may be something to the fact that because the bench is as short as it is, because there are so many players out, that certain players are playing with a level of freedom because they know there is zero chance they get pulled. Sure. I think that Ramey, he's not the only one, but if we're focusing on him, I think that Ramey and Shaka's relationship has been somewhat contentious. You know, there's been good and bad moments, and, you know, they're both just very sort of strong-willed individuals, so there's going to be clashes from time to time. And I think given that, you know, especially the game Matt was out, and currently where Matt is sort of in this kind of, I don't know, this gray area where he can play and he can contribute some, but he's not going to be the ball dominant point guard. Ramey knows that he can go for, you know, aggressive drives to the rim. He can take certain threes, and it's not going to be, well, you missed that, so here comes Matt back off the bench to take you in. And maybe that's something that's happening with Baker and with Cunningham and some of these other guys, is that they're all sort of playing with this, look, none of them have an eye on the bench, right? And so maybe that has something to do with the relative looseness and the relative fluidity they're playing with right now.
I think so for sure. And I think I think that you can pretty comfortably say that there is some very specific roles at this point. Like when Cunningham gets on the floor, he's getting solid minutes, and you know exactly what he's out there to do.
Move the threes. Ball. He's shooting threes.
Yeah. Move the ball, be aggressive and physical defensively. Put a lot of pressure on the ball, like when his man has it, try to deny ball if his assignment's off the ball. Same thing with Will. We know what he's there to do. Same thing with Kai. We know what he's there to do. Same thing with Royce. Same thing with Andrew. Like, okay, Andrew, we need you to be an offensive spark, and we need you to, or whatever it is. It just seems like losing Jericho, losing Jace, having Kamaka out a couple times, having Gerald out, has really allowed the players who are in there, hey, this not only like this is how I want to play, but this is what I am tasked with doing. And that seems to kind of have allowed them to blossom a little bit in those roles. So,
yeah,
you know, before the season. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, and I think with Andrew, before he got sick, he was showing the sort of elite shooter he can become, right? There's a reason why he was considered a fringe NBA draft prospect in his freshman year. A big chunk of it was his shooting. And it feels like, maybe this is small sample size, but it feels like we're maybe starting to get some of the shooting back not that he was ever bad at it, but when Andrew was a freshman and he was cooking, there was nobody who could cook like him, right? And we're starting to see some of that here and there, albeit against some of the worst Big 12 teams. But I'm hopeful that what we see out of Andrew right now is sort of the beginnings of him blossoming back into this sort of elite offensive force that he was, in pieces in his offensive year and starting to be his sophomore year before he came down with injury.
Well, we all knew it was going to take him a while to get back into the flow of things. And it was either you or Tim who said they were watching for the end of this year to see when he's about 90% or so where he is in his game. And it seems to be he's starting to wake up and become a legit threat.
Yeah, I mean, whoever it was that said it, I think that's probably a sentiment that a lot of people around Texas basketball felt like.
It was
definitely
you.
There you have it. Out of the mouths of babes. But regardless, I really do think that he's, you know, someone on our site talked about how this is, you know, he's, I think, like 6 months out of his out of chemo the last time. That part of his recovery seems to sort of be truly in the rearview mirror, or at least is, you know, in a much deeper, better way than it was at the beginning of the season. And he just, you know, there have been times this year where he just looked slow, where he looked like he didn't have the recovery speed, he didn't have that ability to kind of physically match what his brain was telling him to do on the court. Like, just defensively in particular, he seemed to have these little bouts of not being able to even contest shots, or giving too much space, or not using some of his length and physicality. And the last couple games, that has just not been the case. And so whether something is clicked or whether we truly are seeing it like a different physical specimen for him, that's been cool. And then again, I think that he's been able to figure out now, like, there's just this stuff that he can't do. Like, things that 2018 Andrew could do that 2020 Andrew isn't able to do just yet. But that doesn't mean that he can't score. That doesn't mean that there aren't shots that he can be very efficient on. And what I like about how he's been able to attack the last few games is he seems to be attacking, like, okay, these are my high percentage shots. This is where I can be capable and successful. And so he's putting himself into those spots and, like, all right, well, I like my 3-point shots, not from the corner unless I'm on a catch and shoot. So if I'm going to be taking shots off the dribble, I'm going to take a shot from here or here because that's where I'm more comfortable. Or if I'm going to go into the lane, it's going to go into the lane with Will as the person that's screening for me as opposed to Royce. And then I'm going to look for this shot here. Like, he just seems to have, again, you think about Andrew and his ability to think the game, because he just is a really smart, functional kid from that standpoint, and to watch him kind of put those pieces together has been positive. And I think there's a reason. It's not just by happenstance, like, oh, he's on happens to be on a 3-game hot streak. I do think there is a semblance where he seems to kind of understand it a little bit better now.
And I think it helps that the bigs are doing a better job of walling off the paint for guards. I've noticed that in the past couple of games where Baker and Jones, to the extent he can, because he's still not very strong, but some of those guys, Royce and Will, are better at sort of walling off some of the post guys who in other games might have gotten in there to either contest a shot or to force a guard to stop halfway into the paint. They have a lane there that wasn't there before. But to your point with Andrew, I think he's done a better job of not trying to dribble in the paint, and that has helped a ton, because that is where he got picked a ton, is when he's trying to dribble while he's in the paint.
So two things with that. The first is that you're right with Jericho. Jericho did, like, his it was a slip. Like, we wanted him to slip because you're always looking for the lob. That's what you want for him, or you want him to be there for that. So he's not going to wall people off because he was, you know, he's going to avoid the seal because he wants to attack the glass. Whereas, you know, I think you actually kind of have to respect Royce's free throw line jumper. Like, he's a good free throw shooter. He's an okay mid range shooter. So good on Royce for you know, bringing that into
Royce
his game.
Royce was born 25 years too late. He would have been a great five in, like, 1980.
And that dude bleeds Texas. Like, you know, he's one of those guys where when he gets done at UT, I'm, you know, his numbers are going to be pretty insubstantial, but I will remember him fondly. Just the fact that it's like he gets really psyched for the games. He seems really rude on his teammates. I dig that.
Roster's Shaq player.
Right. And then as far as Andrew's concerned, I think you're exactly right. Like, he seems to understand, okay, I'm better off taking a semi-contested 12-footer than I am forcing the issue at 6 feet and getting myself into some really tough situations. So I'm glad that that's another cog in his ability to say, all right, so where am I truly? How is this progression going to continue as the rest of the season goes on? And, you know, look, we'll ride that wave as long as we can. So hopefully it continues for where it can.
So, how carried away can we get here, or should we get here with these 3-0 run? Because it is a little unprecedented, right? And Shaka Smart is fighting for his job, and they have looked like an entirely new team. And now there's the potential for them to finish in a 9-9 record. There is a legit chance for it to happen. And while it is, you know, maybe a 20-25% chance, it's still a larger chance than we gave them credit for after the Iowa State game.
I would say a couple things. One, I'm not getting carried away, because if you consider the three teams they have beaten, one is a TCU team that was 2-7 in their last nine. Actually 2-8, because I think they lost to Iowa State. So they're 2-8 in their last 10. They're not even in the NIT bracketology projections right now.
Got shit on today, or last night, I guess we should say.
Well,
by Baylor.
Well, no, actually, yeah. No, I'm talking about TCU, not K-State.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said K-State. My bad.
Yeah, no, I'm getting there. Kansas State is awful, too. Kansas State may not win 10 games this season, so there's that. And then West Virginia is terrible away from Morgantown this year, for whatever reason. And so while it's nice to see the turnaround from what happened in Morgantown. Absolutely. And it's kudos to the players, to the staff, to everybody involved, that this team keeps fighting the way they do. One of the things I guess you could say about Shaka's teams is that they may not win, they may lose terribly, but they rarely give up. And so there's, this is the moral victory brigade. I don't know. But the point being is that there is an enjoyment that should come from winning 3 in a row in conference, especially given how rare it has been. So enjoy that. But at the same time, it is worth noting that they are coming up against both. They're going to Lubbock against the team that in Tech that is the most difficult remaining regular season game by a pretty fair amount. And then the next game they have is against Oklahoma at Oklahoma, who just beat Tech. So there, it's not 9-9 is a possibility. Yes, the smart money is probably on 8-10 at this point. But it is fair to note that they could pull something out and go 9-9. So I'm not getting overly hyped about their projections forward. But I am appreciating the fact that they are still fighting and they're still coming up with a way to win, especially with the short bench that they have.
That's the answer. That's the answer. If Shaka's going to continue here, well, and Will, you kind of alluded to it. He has never won 3 conference games in a row. That has not happened under Shaka's tenure.
Yeah, it has. It happened his first year. It's the first time since his first year.
I thought it was the year before that.
No, what hasn't happened is a 5-game run.
Right. Yeah, I thought even a 3-game run had. Okay.
And well, it hadn't happened since I believe it was. I think we looked it back, and it was 2013. Or 2012.
Yeah, because that was. So I know the 5-game was the year was Isaiah Taylor's first year. I thought that it was even that it was Rick's last year that there was a 3-game win streak. That makes sense. That it would be Shaka's because we were 11-7. I want to say in conference his first year. So I'm sure that you must be right, Johnny. But
just save that clip, please. Could you mark that audio? Thank you. You must be right, Johnny.
You're right. Like every it's fine. It's fine.
Yeah, but it was so sincere this time. It's just so so honest and forthcoming. I'm gonna go marinate on this. Go ahead and answer the question.
It wasn't followed by I love you guys. I love you, Johnny. You're right.
There was no condescension in that one. For one time, there was zero condescension. It was amazing. All right, go ahead, Tim. What was your answer?
it. Yeah.
Johnny just went,
hand down head and lean back.
So I guess it's what makes this last run so. Why my interest has peaked in a little bit of a different way than it has been previously is, I guess, the last time that we saw Texas run off a string of games against at least decent teams. Obviously, K-State and TCU are not very good, but they're decent. It was the NIT. You know, our wins at the beginning of this season when we were like, what, 9-2 or whatever it was at the beginning of the year.
We beat the shit out of High Point.
Yeah, a lot of those teams that we beat were just not good. And I think K-State is not good. I think they're probably better than McNeese State. Probably, maybe not. I don't know, Bruce Weber sucks. But I guess I don't know. and if you just sit here and just keep on like hoping for some kind of monumental change or shift, like, okay, now Shaka's team gets it. Okay, now Courtney's ready to ascend into whatever. Then, you know, then maybe it is different and maybe there is reason for hope. But probably the answer is no. I mean, Johnny is accurate in saying, like, look, the most likely scenario is this was a weird three-game run where we caught two of the worst teams in the conference at a time that's positive for us to catch them. We caught West Virginia at the, you know, at their low point of the season. And because those three games kind of fell right where they did, hooray for a three-game win streak. If you're looking for some reasons for optimism, it was three double-digit wins, which is kind of cool. You know, we did not beat McNeese State at home by double digits. We beat them by two, and they probably had reason to feel like they kind of threw that game away. That was actually a game where McNeese State should come out of that contest feeling like, oh, man, we let that one slip out of our fingers.
I think I saw that the Texas hasn't won three Big 12 games in a row by 10-plus points since, like, 2011 or something. There was some crazy stat like that.
I wouldn't be surprised. So, you know, should you get hyped? Should you change your perspective about the team? You just can't. You can't, because all I could think about when we talked about the Beeline stuff, and there's a kind of a well-known poster on Inside Texas named Bob, like, that goes by the moniker Bob in Houston, right? I think a lot of people who follow Texas basketball and are like the interwebs of Texas basketball would probably know who he is.
Yep, he's and good people.
Yeah, he and I text back and forth somewhat regularly, and you know, and we're, you know, he and I had this exact conversation, like, where are we at? Is this for real? And I remember thinking kind of like, it might have been after the TCU game, or maybe it was even right before that. But when Beeline, when he steps down or gets kind of unceremoniously kicked off the perch for the Cavs and becomes a realistic option for Texas, I sent him a text saying, so now we're going to win five in a row. Like, now that there's a very viable option who should come to Texas, watch us do away with that. And now, so, and here we go on a three-game win streak. But now I guess I also feel like how devastated I was last year when TCU won that game in Austin by like 16 points, right? Yeah, we just got smacked.
Yeah.
By them. And so I'm like, okay, so now Oklahoma State's gonna punch us in the throat or whatever for that last game. You know, the Stockholm syndrome is real with this team, and you feel like it's just another chance for us to, you know, for how many times can they twist the knife? But some of the stuff feels different. a three-game win streak just feels different, guys. What an incredible change of pace.
I honestly thought the three-game win streak was going to happen one game earlier. I thought it was going to be Iowa State, TCU, and Kansas State. Like, when I charted out this sort of 9-9 path a few games ago, I was like, okay, so they're going to lose three in a row to Kansas, Tech, and Baylor. And then they'll win three in a row against Iowa State, TCU, K-State. Then they'll lose two in a row to West Virginia and Tech. Then they'll win two in a row against Oklahoma and Oklahoma State. They were 9-9, and who the fuck knows? What does this mean? Nothing means anything. I'm time's a flat circle. I'm just stuck.
We're still there. If it happens in 9-9, what does it mean? Does it mean anything?
It's I, here's
I think the end of it is that Texas needs to win 3 games at the end of their season. 3 games. In any order. They just need to win 3. If they go 0-3 to end the season, but in the Big 12 tournament they win 3 in a row, then as unlikely as that is, they're probably in the tournament because they've beaten some really at least 2 good teams.
Yeah.
If they win 2 at the end of the season and then win 1 in the tournament, they're in. They're into the March Madness. If they lose 2 and then they win 2 in the tournament, then they're into the NCAA tournament. It's just they have to win 3 at the end of this year. That's it. Which so, 3 that is, it doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, I agree with your sentiment, right? Like, I understand where you're coming from. I think it's sort of like, I think you're on the right path. I think the sort of fine tuning I would give is that who the 3 are matters, right? Like, if they go and beat Oklahoma and Oklahoma State but lose to Tech, then they're probably going to be in the 4-5 matchup against probably West Virginia at that point. And then if they win that, then maybe they start, they're probably on the wrong side of the bubble, but they're at least on the bubble. If they lose these 3, then they're probably like the 7 seed, which means they got to beat K-State. And then that means that they're going to have to fight against Baylor, probably, is the 2 seed. And if they win that, then they'll have a match against Kansas, Tech. I guess, or Tech. Yeah, Tech. So, yeah, so then at that point, it's like, okay, they ended the season 7-11, but they beat K-State, Baylor, and Tech. And so you're like, I don't know where that puts them. This is the Shaka Smart tenure in a nutshell, is you're living on this knife's edge of uncertainty where I don't know which way you're going to go. Are you going to be an 11 seed play-in game in the NCAA tournament? Are you going to be a 2 seed in the NIT? Like, I don't know where you're going to be, but that seems to be sort of where we're at. And this is this basketball purgatory where we're not shitty, we're not great, we're not good, we're just right on that edge of almost having something going, but not really. It's like going to a really nice strip club with super hot women and they do a dance and then they just don't take off any clothes, but they take your money anyway. But then another one says they're interested in you and you're like, okay. And then they don't take off. Maybe they take the top off. No, they probably don't take the top off. And then it's just, you just like, there's like 3 dances in a row where you're like, I feel like I should have gotten something more than this, but I didn't. And
$60 in the drain.
Yeah, it's like plus tip. So you're probably out like 80 at least. And then because right. Look, they work hard for their money. You know, it's uncomfortable in those shoes. They should get a tip, whether they took anything off or not. The amount of tip is really sort of variable. But like, I'm just saying, like, women should be empowered is really what I'm saying.
Thank you, Johnny. That's where we were going with this entire show.
Yeah.
I think we can end pretend we're football now.
This is a female empowerment podcast.
I like playing Jedi Fallen Order on Xbox. That's where I'm going to go with my part of this statement.
Yeah.
Off air, we can talk about strip clubs in a very different way. I've only been to 2, and I'll never go again, and it was a long time ago.
That's because you're in Iowa.
Yeah, it's not exactly... Look, you need to come to Dallas. We're going to get you high as shit, and then we're going to take you to a strip club. And then the next night, it's nothing but Molly. Just a bunch of MDMA.
Jeez.
MDMA and Xbox. You're not going to be able to resist.
So let's go ahead and say Shaka Smart does win those 3 games at the end of the year, where he's either 9-9 or, you know, whatever. However he wins those 3 games. Do they make the tournament, and does even making the tournament save Shaka Smart's job?
I think so. I think so. If they make the tournament, I think that he'll get brought back. I'm not going to claim inside info. I'm not going to pretend that I have the pulse on what CDC wants to do. I think that the way that Shaka has structured his program and the way that the kiddos like him how well balanced and rounded a lot of the players are. I think there's a lot of those optics that except for the wins, Shaka has built a really nice positive program for the school. And I guess I think that probably matters maybe more than you know, Joe Fan would like for it to. Here's the full context of how I think about it, because there's a few things that are very important. The first is, I guess, who is a legitimate candidate to replace him? Is there an obvious candidate that's out there that CDC feels comfortable with that can kind of keep some of this infrastructure in place and that will not cause a mass exodus of the players who are here?
John Dayline?
Maybe, right? Whoever that is, that's one part that makes a difference. Another part that is going to make a difference is, what's the money look like? How does that factor into it? Another thing that makes a difference is, you know, what do we do with Hootie and Yaklich?
Hootie and the Blowfish?
So I just think it's, you know, another thing that makes a difference is, what happens to Aston? What does the football team look like next year? Like, I mean, if Texas football is 6-6, I think Herman's going to get the axe. But you probably, I mean, even CDC understands that you can't really truly get rid of everybody. You can't replace all of these really high-level coaches or high-profile coaches. And then, you know, the biggest thing for me is, you still have that question mark of Greg Brown. What's he doing? And is, you know, I mean, shit, if Shaka wins one more game and we go 8-10 and Greg Brown's family says to CDC, we're ready to come, we won't be there if Shaka's not there. I think that, you know, like, it would be tough to fire him in that situation, or tough to let him go. I guess there's just so many layers, and I know that it's stupid to hinge on, like, what's going to happen with Shaka? Well, what happens to the assistant coach? What happens to the strength and conditioning coach? Why should that fucking matter? But it kind of does. Why do we just hinge it on one player? Well, because Greg Brown could be a true impact player difference maker, or, you know.
And more than that, he is the position that would have really benefited a guy like Jackson Hayes, Mo Bamba, and Jarrett Allen, where Texas finally has a base that he can complement instead of him having to be the base.
Well, he's just different because, like, you know, he's a 6'8 guy who can put the ball on the floor, who can shoot some, who would be probably immediately the best finisher on the move that we've maybe ever had at Texas. Like, he's special in the open floor. Oh, who are you thinking would be better as a finishing open floor?
I mean, we have had KD at Texas.
But I wouldn't say wonderful.
Brock Cunningham?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, what the hell, Tim?
KD
Drayton
was...
Whiteside?
Yeah.
Okay, I guess I'm losing this argument.
It's beautiful Drayton Whiteside. Beautiful, formerly pure Drayton Whiteside.
R.I.P. R.I.P. in peace.
Yeah, he's not dead. Just his pureness is dead.
No, he basically is.
Okay.
Rest in power.
Fair enough. Like, I am going to disagree with Tim, and maybe this is a disagreement of reality versus concept, of reality versus theory, in that as much as Greg Brown is a really interesting player. As much I've watched him in person, and he is really impressive, I would be super happy for him to come to Texas. I do not think if I am CDC, what I am looking at is, I am looking at the whole of this program, and I am not going to base my decision on Greg Brown because he is going to be gone 6 to 8 months after he shows up on campus, right? Like, he is barring some sort of LaMarcus Aldridge sort of injury, he is a for sure one and done. And even then, he's probably still a one and done. So what you're saying is, I mean, I guess if you, the way maybe you're, maybe this is sort of what Tim is thinking is for CDC is, if you get Shaka to sort of this edge of NCAA tournament viability of this, well, we can bring Greg Brown in. It gives him an excuse, right? It gives him a reason to delay this 12 months and save himself $3 million in terms of a you know, payout. So maybe in terms of that and sort of strategic thinking, it gives CDC that. I feel like if I am an athletic director, I am looking at the sum of the parts. I am looking at, is this coach going to take this program to where I want it to go? If they are not, especially given the sample size we have of Shaka at this point, I'm not going to let one recruit, however great, sway me on that. I understand sort of the, I mean, if I understand Tim's argument, it is effectively sort of, we're at this point of maybe not, and maybe Greg Brown's sort of flips things to the positive as opposed to the negative.
He's the tipping point.
Yeah, tipping point kind of thing. Is that fair, Tim?
Yeah, so, you know, if you go back and look at when Rick was most successful, I think you can, as good as Durant was, and obviously transcendent, as good as LaMarcus was, as good as Brad was, as good as Tristan was,
Brock Cunningham,
you can follow their success based on these really, really good guards. So TJ comes, Daniel comes, DJ comes, Avery Bradley, Corey Joseph, Jacobin ?
Yeah.
And then what? And then Isaiah, I guess.
Mick. Mick was sort of theoretically supposed to be, right? Yeah.
But Mick is the Matt Coleman at this point. Like, and I love Matt, but like Mick is kind of the Mac or Mike Kabongo, sorry.
Mike Kabongo.
Like,
yeah.
But Mike, you know, as much as I really appreciate Matt Coleman, like there's no question that he has not brought the wins that I thought he would, and a lot of teams thought he would. So, but if you want to know why I think Greg Brown could be this harbinger, is after TJ showed people you can win at Texas, you can win, then we saw this string of high level guards, 5-star or borderline 5-star guards come. It's a silly argument. I get that it's a silly argument because I'm saying, like, well, when after Greg comes and we're really good, then the floodgates will open. But I guess no matter who is here, you kind of think that in this environment, in this conference, against these kind of defensive coaches, you just simply need those really good guards. And if people see with Greg Brown being added to this team, if Texas can get a 25 or 26 win season and Shaka gets that guy, you know, and it's hard to say that, you know, Andrew Jones wasn't that guy because he certainly could well have been had he not, you know, fallen ill. But if Texas can actually get that guy, what could this program be, no matter who the coach is? Like, whether it's Shaka or anybody else, but does that year of Greg Brown, like, what do we lose? Like, potentially what we could gain by okay, getting the De'Aaron Foxes of the world, getting who whatever by them seeing, okay, Texas is good enough that I can go there and win. Does that allow us, you know, does that give us the chance to recruit players of that ilk?
Texas has not won 25 or more games since 2011.
I feel you. Yeah.
I understand where you're coming from, right? But I don't think Matt Coleman was good enough that Duke was hard after it, right? Like, yep. he was a high four star guard that a lot of high level coaches wanted. Coach K wanted him, so obviously he was pretty good, right? I don't see Greg Brown being this harbinger for Texas. And if anything, he's a harbinger for developmental wings who will end up being here for 8 months, shoot, 29% from three, and then go make a shit ton of money in the NBA. And so, right. I as much as I really like Greg Brown and I would love to see him at Texas, it's not exactly TJ coming to town, right? And so, I guess for me, it is, if if I am an athletic director, I'm looking at the long view, right? I'm not looking at a single season. And maybe he's looking at a single season in terms of $3.1 or $2 million, whatever is off the end of the end of the deal 12 months from now is enough to keep going. And then the next year it's like, oh, well, it's instead of 10 and a half, it's, you know, 7 or 7.3 or whatever it is, right? Like there's that. But in terms of where I want the program to go, I have a sample size on Shaka that is nearly five seasons long, and it is not good enough. And them being 8-10 and being a first four team, or like, you know, say they're 9-9 and they're a first four team, they're an 11 seed, and maybe they win that play-in game, and then they get fed to some mid-major team that's a six seed, then like that's not enough to say, oh, well, this whole team's coming back next year plus Greg Brown. I'm like, okay, well, then they're a nine seed, an eight seed. Like what is the realistic jump there? And I don't see some sort of argument for a massive improvement that goes, oh, well, that's the year they're really going to do something. And on top of that, even if they do something, then they got to replace a shit ton of them the next year because there's like five guys that will be leaving at the end of that season, four or five guys. So it's like, I feel like at this point, people who are arguing for Shaka to stay, the few of them that are arguing for Shaka to stay, are sort of chasing the dragon at Vegas. They're down $600 at the blackjack table being like, if I just hit a few times. And it's like, you haven't. So at what point are you going to hit, right?
Yeah, yes, for sure. But what if TJ chooses Louisville? He doesn't. But what if he chooses Louisville? Because that exact same team, literally the exact same team that TJ took to 2 or 3 points from the Elite Eight, got smashed as a five seed against Temple the year before.
I don't see this team with Greg Brown being a five seed, period. I mean, maybe I get, you know, maybe Neil Berry figures some shit out and like refines the system so that offensively they're better. Maybe Shaka and Jaklic sort things out so that the defense, which has been really good, takes another step. Maybe Febres and Jones and like the guards together sort of come together. This is a lot of ifs. Maybe that happens. At this point, Shaka has been unranked more than ranked. And so projecting a team of his to be higher than a six seed is questionable at best. So
no, I feel that. I feel that. I don't think you're wrong at all about that. I'm just simply saying, if there's no TJ, there's no a lot of guys.
Sure. I just don't see Greg Brown being that guy. I just don't see him being the Pied Piper. Like, especially with Durant still playing, right? Like, it's not like it. Before TJ, there was nothing. I mean, not nothing, but like there was LaSalle Thompson, and there were a handful of guys here and there.
Chris Clack.
Chris Clack was awesome. I'm very happy. I was happy to watch that dude. But it's there isn't a. I don't think there's a modern Pied Piper equivalent of TJ with Greg Brown or whoever, because Texas already gets a lot of people in no small part because of what TJ set forth, right? Like he was the catalyst for a lot of things that happened. The fact that KD and a bunch of these other guys are still playing in the NBA, they're all an advertisement for Texas. So I just don't see a TJ like scenario here. I mean, maybe there's like a ninth grader in Addison I'm completely unfamiliar with who turns out to be this five-star stud or whatever who comes in and reinvigorates things, right? Like maybe there's that. I don't think there's going to be another TJ because there doesn't have to be another TJ. There's a KD who has shoes that everybody wants to wear, and his name is emblazoned across a bunch of stuff, and he's given millions of dollars, and like there doesn't need to be a TJ for them to continue to recruit well. And I just none of this is contingent upon Shaka, right? Like him, as much as I appreciate him, and as much as he is a good dude, and I wish him well wherever he ends up, I don't see a scenario like this being contingent upon Shaka, because theoretically, whoever they would get to replace him should be able to recruit at a reasonably high level so that he can go get, if not Greg Brown, he can go get a bunch of four stars and stuff. Right. So I just don't see this sort of cliff-like downside, I guess.
I think his point where it really differs from mine is, I think he's far enough along with Shaka to be like, all right, this guy doesn't have it. And I guess I still feel like it's so player dominated and that players do make that much of a difference that I guess I would disagree with how important I think a guy like Greg could be.
Well, how far into his tenure was Rick Barnes when he got TJ Ford?
Rick came in 98.
Was 98, 99 was his first season, right?
Was his first year, yep.
So TJ was 2002?
TJ came in 2001, 2002 was his first year. So four? Yeah, like his third or fourth year.
Committed three, played four, something like that.
How was he before him? Remind me.
Fine, bad in the tournament.
But he was in the tournament.
Had some credit. Well, it's tough. That's tough. Because again, you can't overlook how shitty the Big 12 was.
Because he kept making it even in a shitty Big 12.
Yeah, but
Big 12 is pretty shitty this year.
it's fair. It was good. He was fun, and he had some really bad luck. Chris Owens got hurt early, and he was a very good player. Maurice Evans was a guy who I think a lot of people just assume would stay to a senior year. Maurice took off early, so that team could have been really good. But the year before, you know, as good as TJ was, the year before he came was the year that they got really that class that kind of established everything that had Mouton, Ivy, Klotz, James Thomas. Might have just been those four, but like, yeah. But they added TJ to that group, and then, yeah, had some real success. So it was good. I think a lot of Texas fans are this. Hey, Shaka's not good enough. He's not good enough, no matter who is here. And so why bother with it? That's not something I'm willing to say, no matter what sort of the results are. So that's why the impasse exists, I suppose.
Sounds good, Johnny.
No, I feel like I have thoroughly owned him in the same way Elizabeth Warren owns Mike Bloomberg in every debate. So this is good. Yeah, that's right. It went political. That's right.
Tim is missing some special context between Johnny and I's text conversations that we'll get to that after the show.
Yeah.
But pretend we're getting to know us.
Yep.
Yeah, word up.
Pretend you're getting to know us this week is, what is the coolest thing that you own that is over 30 years old? I thought this was going to be an easier question than it actually was for me. So, y'all want to go first?
Sure. So, mine is pretty straightforward. My dad, so I will be 40 in a couple months, so it's the 25th. So, on April 21st, I will be 40, so... you know, midlife crisis and the like. When we lived in Texas, my dad played a lot of softball, and he was a pastor in Austin and then in San Antonio. And I remember going with him when I was young, like a little kid, like, you know, like elementary school, and watching his softball games in San Antonio. And he had this kind of like super retro, very obviously like 1980s vintage shirt that just says Methodist on the front. So on the front, it's just a shirt, you know, it's got the white piping around the neck and on the bottom of the sleeves. And it just says in white letters, Methodist. And on the back, it says Preston. And I have that shirt. And it does a bunch of things for me. Like, it makes me think of, like, my time in Texas as a kid, which I just obviously very fondly. But it also is, like, a connection to Texas for me, which is cool. And it is, like, you know, think about my dad having worn that. Like, I remember For some reason, whenever I think about him playing softball, there was one time when he slid into second base and was safe, which I can remember like thinking like, wow, my dad just did that. That was like an athletic move. And so like it makes me like, you know, there's still some hero aspect of my papa's. It can, you know, he's still got it, or he had it 30 years ago. But yeah, so I love that shirt. And obviously very sentimental and not anything that anyone else would care about. But that's my coolest thing that's over 30 years old.
Cool. Johnny?
When I was, I don't know, we'll say 12-ish, I got really into skateboarding. And I was...
all had that phase. Everybody had the skateboard phase.
Yeah, I think that's probably pretty common. That's especially amongst white suburban kids. It's a lot of hey, I just like to skateboard because I'm a rebel within the confines of certain things. Yeah,
I'm radical.
So yeah,
like Sharknado.
Yeah, yeah. So when I was they didn't have that when I was that age. So
so you really didn't know what radical was because you had
no I knew radical. Yet. They did not have Sharknado.
No, but I'm saying you didn't know what radical really was because you didn't watch Sharknado.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Yet. No, yeah. I was white suburb radical. It's probably fair. Mm. So
radically Christian.
Yeah, something like that. So I was I got into it and I begged my parents to get me a skateboard and like I learned about it and like I got like good wheels and I, you know, like I saved up to buy the whole thing.
Wheels and a board and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I still have my Kevin Staub mini board.
Are those old clay wheels?
Those are bullet wheels. This is from like 88. 89, and it's I rode it for like 6 months, give or take, and then had a very bad wreck and decided that was not for me anymore. And I went and just out of curiosity, I went online to look up and see what that board went for, and like apparently someone sold one for like $800 recently.
Whoa!
Yeah, it's like a vintage thing now, I guess, or something. So. Yeah, I got a Kevin Staub mini board. That's the Tortuga board, and it still has the original monster trucks on it. It's still got the original bullet wheels. Well, three of them. One jackass I knew busted one off and grinded the monster truck into oblivion. So probably gonna have to replace that. But otherwise, it's in incredibly good shape, and I probably should frame it or something. So that's my thing. And
it's nice wall art.
Yeah. It's, I mean, I guess it's about 32 years old, give or take, something like that.
Huh. But,
yeah.
All right. Did you like thrash with a shit ton of rad?
Yeah. Or? Something like that. Yeah. It was very much during the 720 degrees video game sort of phase, you know?
It's tricky to rock around, to rock around.
Yeah, this was me. Like I would try to ollie, and sometimes it happened, sometimes it didn't. You know, like it was about as good as you could get at skateboarding, given only about 3 months of off and on trying. But so I really felt like I was into it. I had the bowl cut. I still have a shirt from back then too. It was a Tony Hawk shirt from back then. That one, it's still in good condition too, so who knows? I don't know. Like, I guess what I'm saying is, please don't rob me, anybody.
My skateboard that I had was really wide, like super wide. Okay. So I don't know what the functionality was, so obviously.
A lot of stability.
But what I ended up really liking with that was that I could lay down on it and then just like, use my arms to get myself going really fast, like a surfboard or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's what I like to do. I didn't like to like stand on it. I like to just lay down on my big wide skateboard and do that. It was great until one day I hit a lip that was like a 2.5 inch, and then I went like straight head first into the asphalt because I was going so fast. But and that was the end of my skateboarding experience.
So.
Oh, that one doesn't roll very far. All right, let's do this one.
I don't know if I still have my skateboards. I probably do. I should probably get those. They're probably waterlogged.
pretty damn bad. But for me,
how's the skateboarding scene at Wash U? Is it a skateboarding kind of place?
Definitely wasn't skateboarding at Wash U, but they definitely, there was a lot of long, like mini longboards, mini boards, okay, whatever they're called.
Mini boards, yeah.
Mini boards, yeah. That was, yes, that was the thing, and I was like, eh, not
two
for
of
me.
The wheels still roll really well. The third one, not so much.
Rust will do that.
Yeah.
But for me, the most obvious thing I can get
was the head of a World War I prisoner.
Close, no, but the second most obvious thing that I could get were some baseball collection items. So I like to collect sports memorabilia. Some of it I've gotten myself, like a Ricky Williams signed ball during his Heisman race. There's the 2000, I believe it's five Texas baseball team signed a pendant for me because I was the bat boy at that time.
I just really like the fact that Will was getting Ricky Williams' autograph at the same time I was living in the dorms with Ricky Williams. It's like Will was like six, rolling up, being like, "Hello, Mr. Dreadlocks," you know, and I'm like, "Get out of the way, we gotta get beer." You know,
you were a bat boy at the Dish for the
Horns? I was for a few games.
What a homeboy! I love it.
Yeah, and I also was one of the floor moppers back when they let kids do that at the basketball games.
Yeah.
So,
and same,
now,
man.
Now
they
it's
do,
a professional
they all
job.
Look like children to me at this point, so I feel like
no,
they
I'm
still
in,
do.
Yeah, yeah, I guess you're whatever. But I liked, I kind of fueled a like of sports memorabilia on top of my dad's collection, and my dad kind of gave me some of his collection. And two of the cool balls I have a few of, like, I usually like to keep around teams that I care about, but I have things like Herman Kilbrew and other things like that. I have an Ozzie Smith ball because I like to keep things that are, you know, actually kind of matter to me, which is teams that I care about.
Yeah, no, the Cardinals ones make sense.
Right. So Ozzie Smith, but here are two that I really enjoy. It's a Stan Musial ball, and it was his 3,630th hit. Stan Musial official ball. So signed by Stan Musial. I don't know if y'all know who that is.
Yep.
But known as Stan the Man, one of the best players to ever grace the sport of baseball. A very, very well-respected Cardinal and just baseball player in general. Died 2 years ago, I believe.
How'd you get it?
Auction.
Yeah.
And then the next one I have is Bob Gibson's Hall of Fame ball from 1981. It is in this special case right here. I'm showing it for the two guys here, but you can see Bob Gibson's autograph
there
in the Hall of Fame 81. So those are probably two of the cooler things that I own that are older than 30 years old. And in large part due to the help of the father. It's cool. It's cool.
Yeah.
To have, I guess.
No, that's some rare stuff. It's always interesting, especially if you can get it sort of verified, right? It's like that's
right.
Kind of
that's the thing is, yeah, I like to have cool little collector items like that, you know, scattered around. But these are two of the cooler ones that I own. Do y'all
awesome,
have anything? Any cool sports memorabilia?
I have a helmet that is signed by Ricky Earl and Priest Holmes.
That's cool. That is cool.
The other thing that I had that I was actually going to be the backup thing I brought tonight was after the Elite Eight run in 90, I went to the Irwin Center. You know, Dad took me to the Irwin Center. I was not old enough to drive at that point. And they had a signing thing. So I have a program from that has got like Blanks, Mays, Wright, and some other people signed to it. So I still got that around as well. Ernie Banks threw out the first pitch at a Texas baseball game, and I got him to sign a Texas baseball program.
That is a cool one.
Yeah.
Another pretty unique item I have. I don't know, unique. niche is a Jim Hart signed football. Jim Hart, who played for the St. Louis Cardinals, the football St. Louis Cardinals, from 66 to 83, when he was their quarterback, four-time Pro Bowler, won all sorts of awards, but never won a Super Bowl. It's kind of a mediocre quarterback, but I have his signed ball in my room because it's interesting. I found it at a small little thing, and I was like, funny. All right.
I have a katana blade signed by Randy Jackson from American Idol.
Hell yeah!
Because did we just become best friends.
I had this katana blade and then Randy Jackson was in front of me and like, what am I not going to get his signature? Like that's just dumb. So, anybody want to check some night vision goggles out?
Night vision goggles and a katana.
Yeah.
Hell, I have a Texas Johnny. Flag that was signed.
Do you also
by
have
the...
a body pillow?
I have a Texas flag that was signed by the 1997-98 Longhorn men's basketball team that went 14-17. That was fun.
Hell yeah! All right.
They came. Texas played at Iowa State, and I had my flag and
they were clearly not doing anything that night, so they walked by and signed your flag. Like
one of the student trainers or like student like whatever managers was like, I can take this to the locker room for you if you want me to have everyone sign. I was like, yeah, that'd be sick.
So that's what happened with my pennant for the baseball team.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized one day I just had it actually in my closet, and I was like, I've had this Texas baseball pennant in my closet forever. Wonder what year that was. It was 2005. I was like, I was like, is that the year I'm thinking of? And I was like, that's the year they won the national championship. I have every like Houston Street on there and stuff like that. Like, holy shit.
It's good to be the king.
But yep, I think that's gonna about do it for us. Thank y'all for pretending we were football for the past hour and 15 minutes, 10 minutes. I don't know. We're always over. I have been your host, Will Baizer. You guys can find me on Twitter at WILLBAIZER. Mr. Johnny Brashear, where can we find you?
I'm on Twitter at BitterWhiteGuy. I'm on Barking Carnival. I'm also on the Pretend We're Football podcast. You can find that on most of your streaming platforms, Google Play, Stitcher, let's say Bubble Grinder. It's
my favorite.
It's a new one.
That's mine. That's the one I use.
It's like a dating app, but podcasts. It's really awesome. It's where I met Tim. And that's pretty much it, I think.
Mr. Tim Preston, where can we find you being most comfortable?
Everywhere. The whole world is my comfortable oyster. Perimeter, down low, right in your fucking face. On Twitter at Inside Texas Hoop, no S, and then at InsideTexas.com. A lot of contentious basketball posting on our website, so if you dig that, come on and join us.
I always ask Tim for the best comments about the show on Inside Texas, and it's always arguments.
It every single basketball thread.
I'm always like, did anybody answer the pretend you were getting to know us question? He's like, no, they just want to know whether or not Shaka Smart's gone.
Yeah, they want to shit on Shaka, or they want to kind of contextualize why we're bad but not that bad, or whatever. They're all the same, and I find them all endearing. So it's good. A lot of nice people, a lot of cool stuff.
Tim
and
loves everyone and everything.
10 to 20 total douchebags who. I don't know, could die for all I care. I don't know.
Retract my statement.
It's good. I love the place.
It looks like you have something to say, Johnny.
No, come hang out with us. Oh,
no. Johnny. No, no. I reserve the right to not comment about Inside Texas.
All right. On that note, I think we're getting off there. Thank you for pretending we were football, and we will see y'all next week. Hook 'em.
Hook 'em. Johnny never says hook 'em.